Hello and welcome to this episode of In Conversation With by Kangaroo Minds. I am Vedika and today we have with us Ms. Bhavna Isar. Bhavna is the founder and CEO of a social venture called Caregiver Sathi, which supports caregivers in their well-being across the various spectrum of social psycho supports, which include providing them assistance through coaching, counseling, training, as well as support groups. After her stint in a corporate HR, Bhavna is now an organizational consultant as well in the area of change, leadership development, and organizational building. Bhavna's story was also included in the best-selling book, Touch the Sky, which features stories of women across India who are changing their destiny. Before we begin our conversation with Bhavna today, which centers around caregivers and the mental health of care which comes with caregiving, we'd like to put out a trigger warning for our audiences. If at any point during this conversation, should you find yourself feeling triggered or distressed, we urge you to take a step back and look after yourself. Should you need any additional support resources, you can also find them on our website. And now, without taking much time, let's dive in to hear more from Bhavna. Bhavna, welcome to the episode. It's so lovely to have you with us today.
Thank you so much, Vedika. It's lovely that you're doing this work.
No, I mean, I'm really, you know, I think this the work that you're doing with caregivers and, you know, around the space of caregiving is so important. And I know that that's also an area which is very rarely addressed, you know, be it in a generic health context, but also more specifically in a mental health context. So I'm glad that, you know, we're going to have this conversation with you. So, you know, Bhavna, one of the things I'm going to ask you, like, just to start off our conversation, and I know you probably get asked this a lot, but, you know, more for the benefit of our audiences, like, how would you define, you know, caregiving as well as a caregiver?
Sure. So in my mind, let me do caregiver first. I think caregiver is anybody. All of us are caregivers mm-hmm. for the simple reason that we connect and we are social beings. And I do think that it is not just restricted to humans. I think it's a fundamental living trait. Mm-hmm. Having said that, over a period of time, caregiving has, or caregivers are restricted in definition to those who are looking after someone else who might be vulnerable. And I think that that vulnerability could be of any kind, let's say mm-hmm. the physical, mental, emotional, social, financial. And so the expression of concern for another person mm-hmm. through certain behaviors is care. And, you know, we care for each other in different forms and shapes. Sometimes we care for children, and sometimes we care for the vulnerable population, and sometimes mm-hmm. we care for the aging, and sometimes we care for friends who might be having mental health, exhaustion, and various other challenges. Mm-hmm. So to summarize, I think the common everyday language is when you are providing care and support to another person in their everyday life, in terms mm-hmm. of supporting them physically, emotionally, mentally, or financially, you're a caregiver. Yeah? All of us are caregivers.
That's very interesting, you know, what you brought up around, you know, the different aspects that caregiving can take and, you know, what it is like to be a caregiver. But so would you say that, you know, for instance, if you're living with someone or you're in a relationship with someone with, let's say, a mental health condition, would that automatically imply that you are their caregiver?
I think cohabiting with someone with a vulnerability or a difficulty means that there is an, you know, there's an exchange, there's a sharing, there is some kind of a relationship. Mm-hmm. Now, the boundaries might be made in different forms and shapes. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I think it's difficult to live in a same space with someone else. You may be invested in different degrees in the well-being of the other person. So you might be a highly invested caregiver because you're doing a bunch of things. You love them. You are duty bound by them, or you know, you just think for whatever reasons. Or you could also be a neighbor, you know, a roommate, a friend. But because you have a connection with that person for whatever reason,
right,
you could be a lesser invested caregiver.
Like, you know, there are so many stereotypes which are associated with caregiving and caregivers, and I'm sure you've come across many of them as well. So, you know, what are some stereotypes that, you know, you would like to call out?
Women are better caregivers. Mostly mothers are caregivers. Caregivers are those people who you hire to do some service for you, is the biggest stereotype. So a lot of people think that the person that you hire to provide the work for you is the caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in my family relationship, I'm doing just what a good daughter does. I'm doing what a wife is expected to do. I'm not a caregiver or a caregiver. Mm-hmm. That's so clinical. Those are all stereotypes around caregivers and caregiving, or that caregivers typically belong to a certain age group. So, you know, 35 to 65 women are mostly caregivers. Not true. Right. You could have a six-year-old caregiver.
No, it's interesting that you brought that up, you know, that caregivers are looked at in a very clinical sort of setting, and we just sometimes almost take it for granted, right? That if you're living with somebody, you are by default going to be there, but that doesn't make you a caregiver. You're just doing your duty to the person. So coming to the role of caregiving specifically, you know, like, a lot of times it's so much more than just physically taxing as a task. It's also, there are a lot of mental health challenges, also a lot of emotional challenges which are associated with caregiving. So do you want to throw a little bit of light on those aspects?
Yeah. So if you were to look at caregiving as work, you would say, what is the work? Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are many aspects to this work. There is a physical aspect to the work. There's mm-hmm. your task of doing a bunch of things for another person. Then there is a lot of mental aspects of doing the work, right? So it's about organizing, it's about knowing the resources, it's about knowing who the experts are, knowing where to go to whom for what, and so on and so forth, organize for emergencies. So there is a lot of mental or intellectual component to caregiving. And then the most significant and the most invisible part of caregiving is the emotional part of this work, which is not just you have to keep the spirits of the other person up and keep the spirits of yourself and many others around you, or contend with a large number of people who will say things to you like, be strong, you know, be positive. Whereas, you know, what you're going through does not give you any reason to be either. So there are many components to the work of caregiving. And one could construe it like burden. So there is a lot of research and documentation of caregiving burden. But I would just call it work, because a lot of people would challenge the idea or the word burden and say, you know, it's the most noble thing that you do. Don't call it a burden. So reference here only about the size of work, right?
Right.
It becomes a burden depending on how you carry it. So if you are stressed, and if you don't have the resources, and if you don't have the infrastructure, you will carry it in a way that it will become a burden. On the other hand, it will be joyful, enjoyable, noble, a matter of gratification if it was carried in a slightly different way.
You know, so in that context specifically, like, you know, why do you feel that it's important that, you know, we talk about the mental health of caregivers and at the same time that even caregivers prioritize their own mental health?
Yeah. I think the nature of the burden of caregiving, the mental burden, the responsibility and the implications of secondary trauma, as you watch someone either deteriorating or you watch someone going through some struggles, is so invisible and it hasn't been called out thus far that not many people recognize it. So there is and the thing about stress and the thing about burden is that it begins to show over a period of time. So, you know, as a child, I remember there used to be this little poem which spoke about how, you know, over a period of time, if there was a stone and there was a rope that went over it over and over, Rasri Avat Javat Se Silpar Pade Nishan, which means that, you know, even a rope can leave a mark on a stone simply by the friction over a long period of time. Yeah. So I think the recognition of the stress of caregiving is that long periods of stress that is associated with caregiving and not having hope or not having you know, a joyful outcome at the end of it is what causes stress, and which is why caregiving for bringing up children is very different from caregiving for someone who is unwell.
Right.
When you are bringing up children, then there is the hope of the future. There is, oh, this child is growing up and learning these things and doing this, that, and the other. And that kind of creates a very different balance. Whereas when it is about somebody who is ailing or deteriorating or facing death, we don't see death like a transition. We don't see death like the inevitable fact of life. We see death as a loss of some kind.
Right.
And therefore, caregiving for that is a bigger burden. But if you go by our texts and if you were to look at death as a transition, as a natural process, as something that will happen to each one of us, then you can do the best that you can. You don't have to save everybody. And therefore, that caregiving can be different. But because it is what it is, caregiving can become a burden. And now increasingly, people need caregiving for long periods of time. And therefore, stress, burden, mental health challenges are higher.
Right. So can you tell us, you know, in general, what are some of the supports available to caregivers? And also, what is the role that, you know, y'all are playing at Caregiver Saathi to sort of support this entire ecosystem?
Yeah. I do think that the modern urban individual who is a caregiver, which is many of us, needs to learn a new set of skills and a new way of being. Even my parents, the kind of caregiving that they needed to do is different from what we need to do. Yeah. For the simple reason that the previous generation didn't live as long as this generation will. Two, our lives are much faster, much more digital, much more difficult than the previous generations was. Three, we are not living in cohesive communities or larger families. So the number of people is much less. So for these reasons, the modern day urban caregiver in India has to build a very different set of skills. There is the need for having resilience of a very different order. There is the need of having emotional mastery of a very different kind. And there is the need of preparing and planning and organizing for caregiving, which is going to be a big part of each one of our lives. Therefore, one of the first and most significant services that we offer is caregiver coaching. It is to deal with the mental health challenges of long-term caregiving. There is also services like counseling and counseling and therapy, and they are applicable for most mental health challenges or most life circumstances. We would like to offer them nuanced for caregiving to acknowledge that the caregiving circumstances lend unique challenges to caregivers. Of course, there are support groups. Of course, there are, you know, so there are one-on-one coaching, counseling, and therapy, and then there are support groups. And then we are building a tech platform through which you can access content and you can access information to be able to deal with caregiving per se. Right. Today, most people deal with the illness. So you have lots of people who will talk about dementia, Alzheimer's, MS, cancer, and so on. And you don't look at caregiving per se. Yeah. So what we are trying to say is caregiving has one component of the medical condition.
Right.
But there is a big part of caregiving that is agnostic to the medical condition. So there are some shifts that are required. The other thing I'd like to tell is it's very important that we shift the narrative and the understanding of caregiving. And therefore, it is very important that caregivers tell their stories. So we have something called Conversations with Gentle Warriors. Right. And we invite all caregivers of all ages to tell their stories. Stories are a very powerful way of not just healing as someone who's telling their story, but also inspiring others, because many people will feel, oh, I'm not alone. Or, right. Oh, this is how it was done. So Conversations with Gentle Warriors is open to any caregiver who may want to tell their story. We do that once a week. We also are sensitive to the fact that caregivers would maybe not want to tell their stories on video and may yet want to tell their stories. So how can they do that? They can do that through our podcast, in which somebody else will read their story.
Right.
It's called Caregiver Diaries.
Right.
And we hope to be able to, so we want caregivers to join the community on our website and watch the space, because very soon we will be announcing a large number of services, and you can certainly access the community already. And you can contribute yourself, and you can get access to experts through the portal.
Going forward, you know, why do you feel that, you know, sometimes a lot of caregivers find it very difficult to open up and share what they are going through, especially, you know, the more difficult parts associated with caregiving?
Yeah. The social narrative around caregiving is that it is noble. It's an act that you do out of duty or love, or it is something that is, somebody with a large or compassionate heart does it selflessly or sacrificingly. And because that is the pressure, the humanness of it, which is the messier parts of it, the places where you feel depressed, sad, disappointed, shameful, guilty, angry, frustrated, are often suppressed. You just kind of say that's the price to pay. But, you know, you just rise above that. So all our mythological stories are grander and larger than life, and they kind of, you know, present it in a different way. And of course, we forget that caregivers are human beings, and human beings experience everything. So you experience resentment and disappointment and anger, and there should be spaces to be able to express those. No, I just think that, you know, like I hear this a lot. For example, like, oh my God, caregiver Sathi, you're doing something so noble, or something like this, that, and the other. And there's a part of me that cringes every time, because that's exactly what I'm trying to shift. Because I'm just trying to say that, can we just normalize this? Can we just recognize that this is as much a part of being human? And in my caregiving journey and my story of care, providing care for some members of my family, yes, I was resilient. There is no doubt. Yes, I was strong and positive and relentless. That is true. Or compassionate. That is also true. But I was resentful. I was full of anger. I had moments or periods, or big part of me was full of shame, and you know, all the other things were also so there.
I think you're very right, you know, that, you know, somewhere, you know, this whole social narrative and, like, you know, the do good as a caregiver. You know, like, we've always been told that, yes, it's very noble to be a caregiver, and, you know, you should sacrifice, you know, everything to be a caregiver. And, you know, when we talk about caregiving in that sense, you're very right that, you know, sometimes there is a flip side to it. There is a price of caregiving which comes in the way of, you know, frustration. You're going to have to give up a lot of things because of your role as a caregiver. There's going to be resentment, there's going to be anger, and on some days there's also going to be a lot of fatigue that comes with it. And one of the things we talk about and we, you know, hear about is, you know, compassion fatigue that comes with caregiving, and this sort of empathy burnout as well. So, you know, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think a large number of us use empathy and compassion interchangeably. So let's just start from that. And recognize that empathy is the feeling of, you know, being able to get into another person's shoes and feeling what the other person is feeling. And for simplicity, I would say that compassion is not just feeling what the other person is feeling, but having the desire and the ability and actually doing something about that. It is important to understand that there is an experience or an emotion like pity. Pity is when you feel sorry for someone else, but there's a hierarchy or there's a difference. I'm better off than you. I feel pity for you. There's a certain tonality that's different. Sympathy, on the other hand, is you feel sorry for that person in a way that there is not so much hierarchy, but you are feeling sorry for that person and it is taking something from you. Empathy, on the other hand, is it's not just sorry for that person, you're feeling what that person is feeling, right? And compassion is that I have the desire and the want and the ability to do something about this. So yeah. Originally, the text was that the compassion fatigue was a terminology that many of us have experienced, that you run out of your ability to, you know, offer compassion or empathy. there has been some more literature that suggests that it is not, you can never run out of compassion. You can, however, have empathy fatigue. Like you may not want to feel what the other person is feeling because you want to hold yourself. You want to have certain boundaries because it's a thing for yourself, right?
Right.
So empathy fatigue is that I'm tired of giving my empathy, my emotions, and now, so because empathy and compassion are fungible words, they are used interchangeably. I would like for us to recognize that any work that has significant emotional components, any helping profession, or anything that is done with others runs a risk of fatigue. So just like we can have physical fatigue, we can have mental fatigue where we want to have our downtime. We can also have empathy or emotional fatigue, and it needs replenishment.
Right.
One of the implications of mental fatigue, for example, is something called decision fatigue. If you are taking too many decisions on a daily basis in the absence of information and conviction, then you can reach a point where you don't want to take any decisions. And both these phenomena occur for family caregivers. Decision fatigue and empathy fatigue, sometimes referred to as compassion fatigue.
Right. You know, when we look at these kind of challenges which caregivers face, and a lot of times people are not aware of it. You know, in the general population, it's either the social narrative, as we said, around caregiving. So, you know, how do you think we can sort of change that narrative? Like, how can we all work towards changing it?
Yeah. I think curiosity is a lovely thing. I think we build compassion through curiosity and suspending judgment. Any new thing. It's a fairly scientific approach. Any new thing that you want to learn, you are curious about it, right? How does this thing work? What's happening in this world? What would you do in a lab? You want to figure out some item, how it works. You want to discover something. What would you do? You would be curious about it. And you wouldn't apply your previous understanding or learning about it to the new phenomena that you're watching. Because caregiving existed in a certain form and shape, and it is shifting, I think the most important thing that we can offer somebody is curiosity and holding back judgment of what we have known in the past.
Right.
So if we are not going to apply our judgment, and if we are going to be curious about saying, oh, so how is this going to work? Right? How does this work? What's going on for you? Tell me, and I will not judge you for what you tell me.
Right.
That's when we will be able to hear stories of shame, guilt, resentment. Right? Because just like Brené Brown says, you can douse and kill shame in empathy. She speaks about shame and guilt. And I think recognizing that shame is I am bad and guilt is what I did is bad, to be able to make that distinction helps the person deal with their emotions very differently. So if we can look at that, should certain set of experiences happen to us, that does not make the person less, that does not make the person bad, instead it's just a part of your life, then we will be able to offer more compassion, I suppose.
I think that's interesting, you know, as you said, like, you know, sort of reframing the way we look at caregiving, also being open to conversations and normalizing and validating people's feelings. So if if you know a caregiver comes and tells us that, you know, they're struggling with their role, or you know, they're feeling that sense of heaviness or resentment or anger or exhaustion with their role, instead of trying to, you know, induce this sort of toxic positivity, just sort of holding space for people, I think that can play a huge role in terms of how not just caregivers feel supported, but how we can change the perceptions that exist around caregiving.
I remember once a young woman came to our support group and she called me and she says, I'll come to the support group if nobody gives me any advice. Or, you know, and she wanted to kind of, you know, test me. And she said, I'm actually going to come to the caregiver support group and say, I want to opt out of caregiving. I don't want to be a caregiver anymore. And she said, do you think people will advise me and convince me that I should stay to be a caregiver? I said, no, not at all. Mm-hmm. And she said, is that okay? Because, you know, in my everyday life, I just keep getting this thing that as the only daughter, there is no opt out.
I think this opt-out thing is very interesting, you know, because it again comes back to not just the stereotypes that we hold, but also the narratives that we have around caregiving, that it's such a noble thing to do. Or, you know, how can you abandon your relatives, or how can you abandon your family? So it sort of almost puts it that, you know, you need to put your needs after their needs, because that's what you're expected to do socially, morally, all of that, but just, you know, giving caregivers that space to express what they're feeling. I think that also makes a huge difference. You know, earlier you mentioned about, you know, especially like how caregiving has changed over the year. We've had a pandemic for good 2.5 years almost now, and you've probably firsthand seen the kind of difficulties, you know, that have emerged. Or have there been any unique challenges that you've seen that caregivers are now dealing with?
In a very strange way, the cause of the caregiver seems to have become front and center. The need for mental health, even today there was an article that I read that spoke about that the pandemic has actually precipitated the need for looking at mental health, and it has brought it to our awareness. Now, are we going to catch the momentum, and are we going to do something about it or not, right? So, at a scale that one didn't expect, the last 2.5 years has highlighted healthcare, health needs, mental health specifically, and so on and so forth, the role of caregivers, whether it is professional or it is family caregivers, in a very different way, universally across the world. One couldn't have imagined this to have happened so soon. The unique challenges that people face, let me look at, divided by geography. So let's say in India, there is the healthcare professions or the world, you know, we have an understaffed healthcare system. There aren't as many professionals, although you see a very large inclination of people wanting to go into psychology and mental health now. But by the time that they will be ready, it will be some time, right? So I do think that care and mental health support requires communities. And caregivers to be able to access communities of caregivers. Unfortunately, most caregivers don't have the time or do not understand the value of support groups or such communities. A large number of them would tell me, for example, that what is there to talk about this? This is a cross that I have to bear. Why would I talk about it even to a therapist or a group of strangers? So, but how can the burden be lesser? Right? The unique challenges for caregivers are the tension between my role, my family, my duty versus the solutions that can make it easy, right? So talk therapy is useful, but it feels futile. Attending support groups is helpful, but who has the time, right? I will be better off as a caregiver if I did everything myself, but then this is at my cost. So there is multiple levels of tension that a caregiver has to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And men and women handle caregiving very differently.
Right.
A large number of employed professional people, both men and women, are, it's easier for them to outsource parts of caregiving. Right? Many women will unlikely outsource it and will take on the burden in a very different way. Yeah. And the other thing is that with the increasing aging healthcare challenges, we are not recognizing the implications this has on children.
Yeah.
We don't even see children as caregivers. But they are.
Yeah.
And families that have long-term illnesses, children carry the brunt of it.
You brought up the aspect of children, you know, as sort of bearing the brunt of there being, you know, long-term illness in the family, be it with someone elderly or a parent or, you know, within the extended family. Do you want to just throw a little bit of light on, you know, what the children go through, like, you know, children, grandchildren who've lived in households where they've seen, you know, the elderly almost, you know, be ill for almost their entire lives?
So if there's going to be a smaller family, and if there's going to be one person who's going to provide emotional care, right? Let's just look at it like this, that there is that much physical capacity,
right?
And there is that much mental capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And there is only that much emotional capacity.
Yeah.
Now, if there were three buckets, I'm just improvising along the way. Yeah. Now let's say that the bucket of emotional capacity is going to be consumed by the person who is unwell. What's going to be left for the child? Yeah. Irritability, lack of time. And I wish my daughter is not listening to this, but anyway, she would say that even without an elderly person in our house right now, my mental bandwidth is much less because I'm busy in my work. I'm occupied with social media and doing my own stuff, right? So the time for her is much less. But as a growing child, and different children have different needs, I can think I'm giving her a lot, but it could just not be enough for her.
Right.
So that's the thing with children, that children could grow up in homes that do not have enough love going around, that do not have enough peace, that do not have enough nurturing energy. Because, you know, there's just so much hassle. Visits to the hospital, doctor, illness, distraction, anxiety, da-da-da. All of that is going on. So then, what kind of a child is this child going to grow up to be?
Yeah. I think it comes back to, you know, you can't, that whole metaphor of you can't pour from an empty cup, right? And when it comes to caregiving, instead of looking at these buckets, it is very draining. So it's like, you know, what is left for the rest of the people? But one thing around caregiving, which sometimes comes about, which doesn't come about, and I think we touched upon it, is when we talk about death, and, you know, with that is the aspect of that anticipatory grief. And I think as caregivers, we feel it first, you know, like it kind of kicks in much earlier than when it does for the other people. So how do you think anticipatory grief per se affects caregivers?
Well, it can affect both ways. One could be most likely caregivers do not recognize that they are dealing with anticipatory grief. So they pick up the signs and they say, like it shows up in the desire to have a line of treatment, for example, to have some cure. Like, for example, I remember one lady who was looking after her husband. She told me, I just somehow want him to get well. I was an elderly person who was unwell and was on his way beyond. And her thing was that I think she couldn't deal with the fear of living alone after him, or the idea of losing a partner of so many years was, just very terrifying. And she didn't know that she was watching this person go or slip, and she's dealing with anticipatory grief, right? So it's not necessary that caregivers will know that they are dealing with anticipatory grief, but they are, because they are visualizing, anticipating, or making up plans. What if something happens when I'm out in the shop? What if something happens? How do I take care of emergency? Da da da. So all of that is going on. But you're not confronting the elephant in the room, so to speak, right? And this terminology is not common terminology. Grief itself was a difficult word. Nobody wants to talk about grief. Then, like the nuances of grief, like anticipatory grief or complicated grief or disenfranchised grief.
But you're right. I feel like somewhere, maybe with anticipatory grief, there is a bit of hypervigilance that comes in because you're observing the
That's right.
person day on day.
That's
But
right.
there's also possibly a lot of guilt, right? Because everyone tells you be
Absolutely.
positive, but you can see the person sometimes deteriorate. So it's like in your mind, you are preparing for the worst. Even if other people do tell you that, no, like, think positive and it'll be okay and they'll be okay. But somewhere it's that balance between both.
And Vedika, I will say something. I might not be very popular for saying this, but let me speak for the caregivers. On many occasions, sometimes, or many occasions, caregivers may actually want the person to move on. When you love someone so much, you can't see them in pain. And you wish for them to be in a better place, in lesser plane. And it can be terrifying to be able to articulate this.
It's also not socially acceptable, right? Because people will say you're being selfish or this is not right, or that now you just don't, it's almost like, no, you don't want to deal with this. It's becoming a burden for you, which is why you now don't want them here anymore.
Whereas it may or may not be that only, it may just be that I can do this for another 10 years, but you know what? This person is not going to have the quality of life, and this person will not have happiness. And it is for this person, because even actually, I will be in huge pain in losing this person. But for the sake of this person, it is better that they actually move on. But I cannot say this. And like Maya Angelou says, there is no agony bigger than a story untold, or an expression not, I'm paraphrasing, of course. But if I'm feeling like it is best for this person to move on, but I cannot say it, it's a huge burden to carry.
I know what you mean. And Bhavna, I'm going to talk about another aspect of caregiving, which I know a lot of times when we talk about caregiving, we talk about people who are either, elderly or, terminally ill. But sometimes we don't talk about, being a caregiver to someone who might have a mental illness or, an intellectual disability. And those are very different challenges which come with that sort of caregiving. So can you throw a little bit of light on, what it's like and what are some challenges that that brings about?
You know, I find it very interesting how among celebrities, right? So we are very influenced by celebrities. You will not find many celebrities talking about, you will find celebrities talking about being cancer survivors, for example. You will find them, some of them now talking about, especially in the West and a few in India, talking about mental illnesses. But as patients, and as people who have encountered it, and as people who have been victorious from it. Right? So that's highlighted and that's made a big deal about. But we just don't have enough stories about the people who care for it. Right? Like, for example, I have huge respect for Deepika Padukone for speaking about depression, but we don't know what it meant for her mother, who was her primary caregiver. Her story is not out there. Or, you know, we know that Imran Hashmi dealt with his son's illness, and it was a very hard period of his life. And yes, it's so lovely that it's behind him. But we don't know what he and his wife went through because they don't talk about it. We know about Ayushmann Khurrana's wife who had cancer. She's a hero. She's a fantastic woman, very strong and brave, very intelligent. But we don't know Ayushmann's story. Yeah. So I think there aren't enough stories about the fear, the anxiety, the struggles of family caregivers that are popular stories, which is why telling caregiver stories in their rawness, not only the victories, is very important.
And I think that's a huge part of caring for someone with a mental illness or, you know, an intellectual disability, because those are not short-term caregiving stories. They're going to take out, you know, for instance, if it's a parent with a child who has an intellectual disability or has autism, the kind of caregiving that that child would need is not short-term.
And thank you for bringing me back to that point. Which is that, yes, so talking about mental illness and care for that, it's there is no victory. Mm. Or there is no, that, you know, at what point will you claim victory?
Mm.
There is always the anxiety that it might slip.
Mm.
Right? So first, they are difficult stories to tell because it's not your place to tell as a caregiver. The person who is ill, it is their privacy, their story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes difficult to tell their story, right? The second is it's very difficult to claim victory.
Right.
Right? What is victory in the case of long-term mental illness? In the case of cancer, you can say the person was cancer-free.
But even if not victory, you know, where is the closure? Because, you know, for instance, if you're caring for someone who's elderly, closure would possibly be when they move on,
yeah.
You know, or like, you know, as you said, in a cancer patient's case, it's when they become cancer free. But in case of something like an intellectual disability or a mental illness, especially a long-term mental illness or dementia, where is the end? You know, where do you say that this is closure?
It isn't. So one of the other things is that I find very fascinating, and we are a long way to go in India, is around addictions. So
right.
It's easier to find somebody from the Western world claiming sobriety
mm-hmm.
and X years of sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and I just feel that, yes, those who are on the path of sobriety is certainly to be celebrated and it's whatever. But even if there wasn't, but they are difficult stories to tell.
You're very right. They are difficult stories to tell. And also it's very hard on the caregiver themselves, right? Because
yeah.
How do you know, is it whose story, it's also whose story is it anyway? It's also that each person would have a very different perspective on the same story.
Always.
Especially in, you know, like a mental health or a mental illness context, because the patient's version of things could be very different from what was distressing for the caregiver.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in context of all the caregiving, and we've spoken a lot about the mental health challenges that, you know, caregivers face and why we need to talk about it, as well as the work that, you know, you're doing in terms of supporting caregivers. But, you know, how do you think that caregivers can practice self-care? Because that's something that's very neglected amongst caregivers. You know, either they feel that they don't have time for it, or, you know, there's almost a guilt which comes with saying, I'm going to take out time for myself. But it's still essential. It's still imperative.
So self-care is more than having a luxurious bath or a spa or a massage or a, you know, time out. I think the most important thing for caregivers to practice self-care or self-compassion, more than self-care, frankly, is acknowledge that there are three things in us. There is myself. There is the role that I play. And there is my identity. And I really need to build the quality of self-awareness to distinguish between these three things. So who am I? How do I see myself? I might be something, but I might see myself as so self-identity and my role, and recognize that I play multiple roles. And caregiving is one such role. And caregiving is not a subset of my being a daughter. Caregiving is not a subset of my being a wife. Caregiving is one part, and wife, daughter, mother is separate. Yeah. And because there are so many roles that we play, there's always tension among them. Yeah.
Right.
And I think that's the foundation. Next is, what are my boundaries?
Right.
I think recognizing the concept of boundaries and recognizing that I have the ability and the right to exercise my boundaries. And my boundaries can change. They can shift. They can shift depending on the person I'm interacting with. They can shift depending on the time of the day. They can shift when in a year, this year versus next year, and so on and so forth. So to understand the concept of boundaries and how it applies to me and how I can exercise my boundaries with compassion.
Right.
So compassion towards the other person and to myself. For example, I don't have to reach a point of irritation, burnout, snap to be able to say, now I need rest. I have to be able to recognize that I'm getting tired.
Right.
To be able to draw my boundary and also say it nicely. I mean, I recognize that you need this of me. But you know, Vedika, I'm not available this week. So can we look at next week?
Right.
And so on. So recognizing self-role identity, on top of that, boundaries, appreciate my boundaries and the other person's boundaries, and know that we can have a healthy exchange and a respectful exchange.
Right.
So the third thing I would say is, we can practice self-care or self-compassion by practicing respect for the other person and respect for myself.
Right.
So can I keep the seesaw, the balance of respect for the other person and respect for me?
Right.
No. Right? Healthy boundaries. And then allow for taking a step back and an aerial view of the situation. Recalibrating.
Right.
Very important. And sometimes we have to recalibrate on a daily basis. I might have done something yesterday which doesn't make me feel good, but am I going to change that next, etc. So I think some space for reflection.
Right.
to be able to reframe, recalibrate, reassess, and say, okay, how am I mindfully going to handle today?
Right.
Then the next thing that I would say is having some rituals that ground us. Now, you could have daily rituals, you could have monthly rituals, you could have weekly rituals, you could have rituals around your birthday, around other people, and so on and so forth. But some grounding activity, some rituals that, you know, anchor you are very useful for self-care practices.
Right.
Yeah. They feed into the idea of who you are and your identity, etc. But that will become a thesis paper. So, and finally, I think practicing of self-care and self-compassion is indulging in your creative expression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think, you know, whatever my creative expression is. It could be the way I wear my hair. It could be the way the clothes that I wear. It could be the way that I cook. It could be the way that I keep my house. It could be what I paint, what I draw, what I knit, stitch, how I take pictures. Right. Whatever your expression, your creative expression,
right,
is at the center of self-care, because it nurtures you.
You know, to wrap up everything that we spoke about, you know, what would be some parting words that, you know, you would give someone who's having a hard time with their mental health right now, who might be watching this or listening to this?
Something I keep, and I'm going to just, it just struck me. So, you know, there's a shlok or a chant from the Vedic world, and I'm talking to Vedika. So, I'm just going to read that out and I'm going to translate that. It goes, Om Purnamadam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaye Purnameva Vashishyate. What it means is, we're a whole. I'm a whole and you're a whole, complete by ourselves. Where we come from is also whole by itself. But if a part was taken out of it, that would be whole by itself. And what would be left behind would also be whole. Right? It's a beautiful chant that just reinforces that you are enough and that you are the seat of love.
Right?
And you're whole by yourself. And even if you were to lose a part of you, even then you would be whole. And if we can remind ourselves of that. Very interestingly, I'm a Gestalt OD practitioner, and I think this is the foundation of Gestalt as well. The idea of the whole. Yeah, that's what I would like to tell anyone. Wherever you are, in whatever form and shape you are whole and complete.
And, you know, that's really beautiful. And, you know, thank you for all your time. Thank you for sharing all your insights and joining us today. It's been a really enriching session. And I think for a lot of people, you know, this was a conversation which was very needed to be spoken about. You know, we don't talk about it enough. We don't address it enough. It's almost one of those, you know, silent parts of society and our lives. And, you know, as you said, we're all playing a role of a caregiver in some way, or at some point in our lives, we're all going to either be a caregiver or need a caregiver. So thank you for that. And lastly, for anyone who's watching or listening to this today, if you're having a hard time with your mental health, please know that, you know, there is help out there and it gets better. So you don't need to struggle in silence. Please reach out and know that you deserve to heal. So till next time, please stay well and stay healthy. Thank you.